This is Moravian Mornings, a podcast discussing the history surrounding the Moravians who settled in Wachovia.
Welcome to this week's episode of Moravian Mornings. This week we are speaking to Bathabara's current potter, Stuart Marshall. This is going to be a two-part episode on the potters and pottery of Bathabara. Before we begin, Stuart, would you mind introducing yourself?
Hey everyone, I'm Stuart Marshall. I am a PhD student at UNCG, and I'm the potter here at Bathabara. I started working at Bathabara about 2 years ago, trying to retrace the steps of some of the earlier potters at the site.
Okay, so pottery is one of the more important trades of Bathabara. Could you talk about the different potters that were at Bathabara?
So the first potter at Bathabara was Gottfried Alst, and he arrived in 1755. And based on the documentary evidence that we have, we actually think that the pottery shop that he built there was the first one in the colony of North Carolina. Now, of course, I want to qualify that by saying that there was a long tradition of native pottery in North Carolina, in what is now North Carolina, especially the Cherokee and Catawba traditions. But in terms of a wheel thrown and kiln fired pottery set up commercial operation, Gottfried Alst, based on the evidence, he was the first one in North Carolina in 1755. Now, there are a few other scholars that refer to a man named Johannes Adam, who was in Salisbury. This is interesting because he's listed as a potter and he buys a lot of land in Salisbury, but we actually don't have any real evidence to suggest that he had a successful pottery shop, and we don't have any surviving pieces of his work. But Gottfried Alst, for sure, we have a lot of surviving pieces, as well as some excavated pieces of his work. So he was born in Europe, and he trained as a potter in Herrnhut and joined the Moravian church there. He was a little bit of a rebel because his father was a weaver, and he was prepared for that trade, but decided to, again, join the Moravian church and learn the potter's trade. By the 1750s, he was in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. He did some pottery there before being sent down to Bathabara in 1755. Now, originally, as y'all know, Bathabara was just supposed to be a sort of a temporary farming settlement. And the early residents there petitioned the bishop, begging for a potter to be sent down so they could set up a shop and have plates, dishes, and everything. He told them to make do with mostly wooden dishes that they had brought with them. And they were not about that at all. So eventually they did convince him that a pottery shop at Bathabara would be a good idea. So Gottfried Alst arrived in November of 1755. And he very quickly started to make some pieces and set up a very successful shop. And some of the first pieces he made actually were tobacco pipes that we have some surviving examples of. And I like to think of these as sort of his business cards because, again, if we think about the backcountry of North Carolina, most of North Carolina's population was towards the coast, and they could import pottery pretty easily. It might have been a little expensive. But in the backcountry, people did not have access to a lot of pottery. So Gottfried Alst, he makes this sort of smaller experimental kiln and starts firing some of these pipes and passing them out, sort of, I think, as business cards to sort of advertise the start of their shop there. And then by May of 1756, he gives these pipes, the Moravians hand them out to a troop of Cherokees that were passing through Bathabara at the time. So already the pipes, Gottfried Alst's work was getting spread all over the southern backcountry. Alst was a true master potter in the Moravian tradition. It was mostly wheel thrown work, of course. He stays at Bathabara until about 1771, when the Moravian church sort of mandates that all the tradesmen in Bathabara need to set up shop in Salem to establish Salem as the main trade center and city. Now, Alst definitely had a lot of help in building a shop so quickly, and he had quite a few apprentices that worked under him. The most famous of these apprentices was Rudolf Christ, and they had a very interesting relationship. Christ was also born in Europe, I believe, but by 1766, there's evidence that he was working as an apprentice for Alst in the pottery shop at Bathabara. He was pretty skilled early on, but even early on, we have evidence that he was not necessarily getting along very well with Alst because he also worked at Bathabara's brewery and later on worked at the gunsmith shop. and several other places. Eventually, it got to be that Alst and Crist really did not get along, and at times Crist would request to be sent away either to other settlements or to other shops to work with someone else. He was tired of working under Alst. And I should mention he was a teenager at the time. May have had something to do with it. But Alst described Crist, his apprentice, described him as a, quote, silly ass or stupid ass, depending on the translation, if you'll pardon my German there. And in a sense, he may have been right, because he truly, I think, deliberately sort of, I guess, undermined Alst's authority. And we also know it was typical at the time for these apprentices to pull a lot of pranks and that sort of thing, and always sort of neglect their job a bit. So we have record that Crist, he liked to hunt and trap, so he would always go off in the woods. And then some later records at Salem, some of the apprentices, I think, actually, they took cats and put them inside the pottery shop on the shelves. So Alston or maybe one of the other potters would come and open up the shop, and everything would be broken. And I can tell you from personal experience, cats and pottery do not mix. I've had plenty of stuff broken. So we know that apprentices, they were certainly reasonably skilled, but they were also, again, younger and maybe pushing back against some of the strict rules they were under, doing a lot of pranks and that sort of thing, and not always getting along very well. But in another sense, though, Alst was wrong about Crist, because Crist, in his day, eventually becomes a very talented, very innovative potter that produces some really nice work. Another potter at Bethabara who's very important to the site and that of Salem too, I did want to mention Peter Oliver. Now, Peter Oliver, we have less information about, but he was born into slavery in Virginia, and eventually he became bound to the Salem Single Brothers for labor. And eventually he learns the potter's trade. He works under Rudolf Crist at Bethabara. So this is really difficult because, in a sense, it's a master-slave relationship and it's also a master-apprentice relationship. So we don't really know exactly what that relationship was like. However, we do know that Peter Oliver had become very skilled during his time at Bethabara as a potter. And we know that he worked with another Bethabara potter named Gottlob Kraus, and they did not get along. For whatever reason, Crist actually presented the issue to the church leadership and asked to be sent back to Salem to work with Crist, who was then the master potter at Salem after Alst. And this is really fascinating because we know that Peter Oliver he was very skilled. He was a very valued craftsman, and he eventually purchases his own freedom, at least partly through his labor as a potter. And the other interesting aspect of that is that potters at the time typically did not sign their work. So we actually, unless we can trace it to a particular shop, that sort of thing, we don't know whose hands actually made the piece. So as far as I know, and as far as is up to date right now, we don't have any surviving pieces of Oliver's work that we know of. But we know, of course, that he did have a hand in making a lot of the pieces at Bethabara and Salem. I think the last main potter at Bethabara I want to talk about is John Butner. Now, Butner operated in what I use now as what we call our potter shop or potter's house, which is that 1782 brick building that's sort of at the end of the street in Bethabara. Now, you can tell from the outline of that building, Butner added on to the side of it to add a shop. He also built a general store across the street where he, at least we think, he sold a lot of his pieces. I have uncovered evidence, too, that he was actually the post office manager of Bethabara, which at that point was called Old Town. So Butner lived there in the 19th century, and Bethabara really was an old town at that point. So a lot of the really early profitability in the days of Alst and Crist. By the 19th century, of course, Salem was the main site for pottery in the area. And in general, Butner was making more utilitarian stuff, more definitely large pieces, but basic storage jars and that sort of thing. Now, Butner teaches his son Joseph, and they carry that tradition well into the 19th century. But we also know that, again, due to the decline in profitability there, they operated a farm John Butner was also a state legislator. So he's sort of dabbling in a number of different things. And we know he did have at least one enslaved man there that was working with him on the farm. We don't know if he was trained in the pottery business or not, but it certainly would have been typical at the time for enslaved workers to at least do tasks like loading up kilns and firing the kilns and that sort of thing. Again, that's speculative, but it is something important to think about. What I would call the main potters that are significant to Bathabra's history, but like I said, there were a bunch of other apprentices and people that helped out with the business there. Originally, Bishop Spangenberg and the other church leadership did not want there to be a pottery shop at all to be in Bathabra. But again, they didn't realize that the French and Indian War would delay their plans for building Salem so much. Really, very quickly, it turned out to be a good decision to send down Gottfried Aust in 1755, because by 1756, they were already producing constant kiln loads. It's really impressive how quickly he got to work. And of course, the main reason that they were thinking of was for the Moravian community themselves, at first at least. And the first kiln order, basically, that they asked of Aust was a set of 100 love feast mugs. They wanted 100 love feast mugs all in uniform size so that they could, of course, have love feasts. And the uniform size, of course, reflects the, at least theoretical, equality within the Moravian system of everybody getting the same share, that sort of thing. They also asked for him to build stove tiles to assemble those ceramic stoves. They're also pretty iconic. And that, of course, was a style that you find throughout Central Europe at the time. Really not in the South that I'm aware of at the time anybody else was using ceramic tile stoves. Moravians were pretty unique in that regard. He also made shingles and some other things, and really some pottery that was not used for kitchen use. So he made oil lamps, chamber pots, of course, and plenty of other things, tobacco pipes also. Very quickly, the Moravians had all the pottery they needed, and people in the area, that is non-Moravians, began to learn that there was a pottery shop at Bathabra. And we have record that some of them came from up to 100 miles away to buy pottery there. Some came from the Broad River in South Carolina. Some came from throughout North Carolina, different parts of South Carolina, maybe even Virginia, to buy pottery at Bathabra. And we also know, too, that not only would people come to the Bathabra store to buy pottery and other things they needed, the Moravians were shipping pottery as far east as Charleston and Cross Creek, which is now Fayetteville, and then as far west as Fort Dobbs, which is really the western extent of North Carolina as a colony at the time. We know, too, that some days when they would open the pottery shop, or really the shop that they were selling the pottery through, the pottery would all sell out by noon. So they would have a full kiln load, or maybe multiple kiln loads that they had prepared, and people would either in advance notice know that there would be a new round of pottery coming out, or they would just be passing through. But some people came 50, 60 miles, and of course, in some cases, up to 100 miles away. And then they would be turned back empty-handed because they had already sold it out. And it got pretty feverish at some times. Part of that is just due to, I guess, the stresses of wartime. Of course, French and Indian War, and later in the Revolution, people needed their basic necessities, and there were very few places to get them. And of course, people were not wanting to travel so much under the threat of war. In the records, I think we have a passage dating to the Revolution in Salem, where there was a Patriot colonel that actually drew his sword one time to push back a crowd of people at the Salem pottery because they had sold out and people were getting ready to riot, I think. So that's how highly desired the pottery was at the time. Of course, by really the later 1750s into the 1760s, Bathabra was no longer the only pottery operation. In North Carolina or in the backcountry at the time, traditions emerging in Randolph County, Guilford County area, but the Moravians had already established that reputation for really good quality pottery, sort of continued to drive the market desire for Moravian pottery.
Could you talk about their different styles?
So I think this was a point of contention, especially between Aust and Chris, as I hinted at. But Aust was a true master potter. very much an emphasis on wheel throne work. And in his day too, though he was very highly skilled and produced a good variety of pieces, he made a lot of basic utilitarian stuff. That was where the bread and butter of the pottery business there, of the basic storage jars and jugs that people needed for everyday kitchen and cooking use. Now, he was capable, of course, of making more stylized pieces, more fancy pieces, I guess you would say, like some of the slipware plates that he became famous for, especially later at Salem. But of course, looking at the backcountry in the 1750s, 1760s, people were really looking, again, for cheaper storage jars for the most part. And that sort of became, again, the issue with Crist and his developing style as he aged. Now, Crist, he was not only influenced by the Moravian tradition that Oust and others brought over, but he began to be inspired by some of the British traditions, like Queensware, Staffordshire style pottery, that we know there were some British potters passing through the area at the time that did at least teach some of their methods to the Moravian potters. And Crist really began to be interested by some of these more stylized pieces. He made things such as tortoise shell patterns, which is typically made with a couple different colors, and you usually take a sponge or a brush and dip it in slip, which is sort of a liquid clay of different colors, and you sort of apply it to the piece, and in the end it gives you a tortoise shell sort of pattern to it. He also made a bunch of different other slipware designs that were not necessarily more sophisticated than what Oust made, but probably a greater variety by Crist. And he also very smartly began to experiment with the use of molds. Now, Oust did use some molds, which were mostly, you know, plaster or wood molds that they could put clay into and then, of course, make a bunch of different identical pieces. Crist realized the utility of that, I guess, and started to make some very fancy plates with sort of a stylized rim to them, the style that you couldn't really make very easily on a wheel. Really in the late 18th century, early 19th century, he begins to make some of the more iconic pieces that a lot of people identify him with, which are the animal shapes. So he makes a variety of bottles that, like a squirrel-shaped bottle, turtle-shaped bottle, fish, crawdad, I mean, really anything you can think of. He made a flask with an eagle on it, which kind of points you to an emerging American identity that the Moravians were sort of, you know, testing out, I guess. So it shows you the full transition from that old Moravian style to some of the British influences and then stuff that it really is uniquely American in style.
We would like to thank Stuart for joining us today to discuss pottery at Pythabra. Be sure to listen to our episode next week as we finish up our discussion with Stuart on pottery.
This has been an episode of Moravian Mornings, a historic Pythabra Park podcast. If you have any questions or would like our hosts to discuss certain topics, please email us at moravianmornings@gmail.com. Or message us on our Instagram page, also titled Moravian Mornings. Thanks for listening. Auf Wiedersehen.